This podcast is sponsored by El Spilio. Visit elspilio.com for the best caving light you'll ever buy, including the El Spilio Grinta 1700. If you've looked at elspilio.com and you looked at the price of the Lunatic and you just thought, I can't do that right now, go back and look at the Grinta. Could you do that? Because if you could, that might be the last caving light you ever have to buy. There's the Lunatic, which is top of the line, and then there's the Grinta, which if you're a serious caver, you can do. What's among the most important things that you have on you on a cave trip? Your light, right? So get a good one. Elspilio.com, and they sell more than lights, too. Save $20 off any regularly priced order over $300 if you use the promo code PODCAST, so don't forget the promo code. Elspilio.com, and I got a link in the description of this podcast, of course, as well. Doug imports the best caving lights on the planet directly to the United States, so you don't have to. So these prices are as low as they can be. Go to elspilio.com and invest in your caving life with the best light you can buy. Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser, former chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto. I'm also a member of the Indiana Karst Conservancy and, of course, the NSS. What's a grotto, first of all? Well, a grotto is like a local chapter of the NSS. What's the NSS? The National Speleological Society. It's our national organization because you really can't and shouldn't do caving unless it's organized. You shouldn't go by yourself. You should know what you're doing. There's a lot of rules, and they're there for a reason. They're not just there for us to be picky and problematic. No, they're there so nobody gets hurt because we don't want a reputation as a dangerous thing, because caving can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing, but quite the opposite if you do. And it doesn't take much to know what you're doing. So join a grotto, make friends. I've got a link in the description of this podcast for you to find your local grotto. And cave trips with people who know what they're doing are way better than cave trips to the contrary, I guess. So get involved and do it the right way. And you'll find that dues to grottos are very cheap. Mine's $15 a year. And the camaraderie and the information that you get from that very small price is well worth it. My guest this month is Thomas Hawkins. What a delightful conversation this was. If you know Thomas, you could probably expect that. But if you don't, you're definitely in for a treat. Sorry for the incorrect information in the last intro to the podcast. Rachel Saker told me about a cleanup happening in Tagg. I said it was in Tennessee. It was not. It was in Georgia. but it was just a little cleanup and it wasn't that big a deal. But I just wanted to make sure I corrected that. And also, I kind of brought it up so that I could tell you, if you're on Instagram, to follow Rachel Saker. She's so much fun. You can find her at Petzl Princess, which I love. I love that handle. Petzl Princess on Instagram. She's already got like, I don't know, a few thousand followers, way more than I have. I'm kind of jealous. But she posts really, really cool stuff. And she does a lot of really cool stuff. So follow her at Petzl Princess. And she also hit me to Syrah, happening later this month, April 21st through the 24th, at the Little River property in Menlo, Georgia, a.k.a. the Tagg site. You can just Google Syrah Cave Carnival, or I think, what's the web address? It's like a super simple one, like Syrah Cave Carnival 2022, or maybe it's just Syrah 2022. You know what? I'll put a link to that in the description as well. And there are scholarships to attend the 2022 NSS convention. If you're a student, that deadline is April 9th. So if you're going to do that, hop on that. Like now. Like as in hit stop and go do that. Because that's coming up. It'll be here before you know it. Scholarships to attend the NSS convention. Because it's not cheap. Even if you're a member, it's like over $200. But if you can get in for free because you're a student and you're into caving, just click the link. It's in the description and it'll tell you everything you need to know. Thank you to the IKC, the Indiana Karst Conservancy, for being involved with the battle against the Mid-States Corridor. Now, I'm not against progress and the building of roads, but I am against them wrecking sensitive habitats and places that I care about. And so the IKC has a number of concerns about this Mid-States Corridor coming through and wrecking karst areas. So I want to thank the IKC for being involved there. If you want to get involved, you can find that. The Indiana Karst Conservancy is very involved. And thank you if you are. And while I'm on the subject of my home state, Indiana Cave Capers, the event that I never miss, is happening August 5th through 7th at where are we doing it this year? It's at Rivervale. Oh, so many cave capers at Rivervale. I think the most I've ever been to have been at Rivervale. It's like, we'll do it at Rivervale and then somewhere else. Rivervale, then somewhere else. But it really is a great place, centrally located around so many great caves. And some of my greatest memories of my whole life have been at Rivervale at an Indiana Cave Capers. So I hope to see you this year, August 5th through 7th. Just Google it, Indiana Cave Capers. And congratulations to Lane Roberts. Lane Roberts, who I lent my El Spilio to not that long ago, she just got a job as an assistant curator at the National Cave Museum and Library in Park City, Kentucky. She got to do some caving while she was there, too, in Roppel from the Dalio entrance. So if you listen to the Holly McClintock episode, as she did just before she went, we talk a lot about Roppel and the Dalio entrance specifically. And so she listened on her way there. And so it was perfect timing for her. Congratulations, Lane. I'm very, very happy to hear that for you. She was, of course, and maybe still is, I don't know, a tour guide at Caverns of Sonora in Texas. But her new gig is going to be there in Kentucky. So very, very cool for Lane. All right, let's get to it. This was a longer interview, which was a delight, by the way. Thomas Hawkins, he's caved all over, but he got started in West Virginia and Germany Valley there. He talks about caving there. He talks about caving in Central America and some of the botany work that he's done there. We talk about interesting caves like salt caves in Chile. And he met up with some friends of mine and ended up going caving down in Mexico. So we talk about that, and he's also part of a big survey effort going on right now in a classic tag cave, which we've also discussed on the podcast, and which you'll hear in just a few minutes. And stay till the end, because there's a little treat from Thomas at the very end. You'll know it when you hear it. This was so much fun. Thank you, Thomas, and thank you for listening. Thomas Hawkins on the Caving Podcast. What would you say the style is that you play?
So I'm playing more like Appalachian old time.
Okay.
It's really the banjo that preceded bluegrass.
Okay.
In the 1920s, 30s, that kind of thing, before Bill Monroe.
Ah, yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Kind of more like square dance, social music, you know, in the hills.
Ah, very nice. What got you into that?
I went to college in North Carolina, and my roommate had a banjo.
and you picked it up, and does that person still play? Do you know?
Yeah, Todd. Yeah, he's a great musician. Yeah, he
okay.
was very impressive. Yeah.
Well, let's start this caving talk with a bang. You've been to the Nika mine, the Crystal Cave.
So the Mina Nika one was Rick Finch's setup, and that was before. Now it's flooded. They turned the pumps off and,
right.
and it's all flooded and closed. But I wasn't on that one. Rick Finch, Pete Miller, Mary Gratch, they went. So what I know of that is through theirs. We did these trips to all these different geological types of caves. And that was one of the few that I constantly kicked myself because I didn't get to.
Forgive me for missing that detail that you hadn't actually been there, but you're associated with some of those folks, and that's a short list of people that have actually been there.
Yeah, Pete and Mary were really keen on getting in there and taking photographs and stuff. Well, you can only stay in there for about 8 to 10 minutes.
Yeah,
because it's so hot that you literally your eyes begin to poach, kind of thing. There's pictures of them just dripping with sweat. And they had a lot of difficulty with photography because the cameras got so hot, condensation, and trying to keep them cool. They had everything on ice packs before they went in, but they were still only able to do like 10 minutes each inside the actual area. And they had it air-conditioned at the time, but it only dropped the temperature a few degrees.
Every little bit helps in that kind of environment, though, I imagine.
Exactly, yeah. It was an interesting story because Rick Finch had been there in the 70s with a bunch of students from Tennessee Tech, and at the time they hadn't broken through into that large chamber. But there's an earlier chamber called the Cave of the Swords where there's quite a few crystals that are about 18 inches or so long.
Wow.
And that's where he went. And he met a minor geologist working there, and they hit it off. You know, he took him into this particular piece. So when they came back in the, when Rick came back in the 2000s, he wasn't sure that they could get into the mine. And so they took a bottle of whiskey and they went and they'd set up a meeting with one of the engineers. And when they got there and he's presenting his bottle of whiskey, the elderly guy leans over and looks at Rick and says, Ricardo, Dr. Finch. And he remembered him from some 20 years earlier. And that opened the door to them actually being allowed to go into the chamber as opposed to just looking at it through the glass of the door.
And a little whiskey diplomacy doesn't hurt either. That's terrific.
It's the way to get things done in Mexico is diplomacy.
Well, we'll come back to Central America because, my goodness, you did an awful lot there. But let's go to the beginning, West Virginia, where I assume the bug bit you, that road cut trip with the geology teacher.
Yeah, I was 16 years old in high school. I went with this genius geology teacher who was very innovative and gave students a lot of chance to just explore things. We were about, I don't know, 30 of us or so on this field trip. We stayed in a place called Thorn Springs Park, which entirely by chance is almost next to where the old timers reunion was held for the first 20 years. And for one of the nighttime field trips, he took us to Kenny Simmons Cave. Well, Kenny Simmons Cave was one big giant room that had a decayed square dance floor in it. It's got a good size, I'll call it a lake. It's more like a pond. Had a couple of boats that no longer floated in there, being used by the local community. And he turned about 20 of us loose inside the cave and said, come back in 2 hours. We had flashlights. I don't think we had helmets.
Oh, great.
And I discovered the sort of breakdown crawlways around the edges of this room. And for 2 hours, just had a delightful time. And I was hooked. I was going to go caving again. And over the course of the next year and a half, we did about 30 caves in the area. And for the next year's field trip, he hired myself and my good friend Nick Ackerman as sort of cave guides to run the nighttime caving trips for his field trip.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. So he saw something in you then.
Well, yeah, it's nuts. At age 17, you know, we're leading groups of kids into caves. We had no right to be going there. Yes, it's my motto in life is act like you know.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's a terrific way to live, I think.
Yeah.
Because that'll get you somewhere.
It opened the door. We got our driver's licenses shortly thereafter. And for some insane reason, my parents let me take the family Fairlane station wagon. And Nick and I loaded it up with, you know, camping gear and all the rope we could get from the high school mountaineering club. They didn't do caving, but they had rope.
Mm-hmm.
And we got some carbide lights and learned how to tie prussic knots. And within the first year, we were doing some seriously good vertical stuff.
Wow.
In Germany Valley.
Just kind of self-taught techniques?
Pretty much, yeah. We had our first vertical cave was Sykes Pit, which is somewhere around 290 feet.
That's a big one, right?
It's a big one. At the time, we'd got a copy of William Davies, The Caves of West Virginia, which he'd written in 1948, I think. But it had locations and maps of some of these things. And we managed to meet up with a sort of generation of cavers who were slightly older than us, who already knew the vertical things. A guy named Sam Pittum, Gene Dybul, some were from Nittany Grotto and some were from Ohio. The Ohio guys called themselves the Hornet Grotto, I think. Nothing to do with the NSS. We just made up names for groups of people.
Yeah, yeah.
We called ourselves the British Tea Cavers. There was another group called the Smith Creek Cavers. And they gave us some advice and directions, locations. We dropped Sykes Pit, and one of the party just couldn't handle the gold line rope and the prussic knots. When you're using gold line, it was a twisted rope that was for rock climbing. It wasn't for caving. It wasn't static.
Yeah.
It stretched 30%.
It would spin too, right?
It would spin. But that meant in a 300-foot drop, you had to ascend 90 feet before you even left the floor.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
And he got about 30 feet off the floor and just completely quit. He had no more gas in the tank. I was below him. I was the last one out. So I had to then prussic up to him, get him off the rope and onto the ground, but tied on, and then prussic out myself. And luckily there were three of us at the top, and we figured out how to do a pull with a prussic knot as a haul line safety, and we dragged the guy out.
Oh my word. I hope he wasn't too heavy.
It was horrendous. I got to say, it was a total eye opener in just how dangerous this could be.
Wow.
And it immediately convinced us to go buy some Blue Water 3 static caving rope, mm-hmm. and Gibbs ascenders, and to learn how to do it properly.
Wow.
But probably our first five vertical caves, Sites Pit, Hell Hole, Schoolhouse, were all on prussics.
And those are classic, are they all Germany Valley caves?
They're all Germany Valley, yes. And now, Hell Hole is sort of linked into Shovel Eater, and Memorial Day Cave is right there.
Mm-hmm.
Schoolhouse is closed to protect the bats. But at least in our day, we were... Like Schoolhouse is pretty much cutting edge. That was the most alpine rope requirement caving you could find in the area. We did seven trips into Schoolhouse. We learned that there's a section at the very bottom, about 300 feet down, called the Grind Canyon, that had been sketched but not properly mapped. And my friend Nick Ackerman is a bit of a genius artistically, and he was really good at mapping. So we decided to map that downstream section. And part of it was mapped by Linda Anderson, an amazing caver. But the whole upstream end hadn't been done. So we made multiple trips down there. Narrow, tiny, you know, you had to be really thin to fit in it anyway. Nobody in their right mind would want to map it.
Wow.
But we had hopes that it would connect to some of the other caves in the valley. It didn't. I suspect nowadays, with perhaps some persuasion, it might. But the cave is now completely closed to protect the big-eared bats that are in there.
So this book, Caves of West Virginia. I mean, it seems like that one came out, you said, in the 40s?
Yeah, I think in 1948, William Davies published that. It was West Virginia Geological Survey.
Is there controversy surrounding that book as far as, like, giving away locations, or are all of those caves pretty much, you know, known now, or were they at the time?
So the whole modern attitude that we have now of, oh, you can't even mention a cave name on social media, you can't give away its location,
sure,
didn't really exist then. You know, in the 1970s, when we were doing this, he had lat long for all the caves in West Virginia that were in the book, and you could pretty much plot them up on a map. And once you got there, you still had difficulty finding them. You had to do a little bit of walking around, because we didn't have GPSs either to get us to the spot. But nobody seemed to be that concerned about, well, we mustn't give up this location because it'll get trashed.
Yeah. But the reason I bring it up is there's a parallel to Indiana. There was this book, I think it's a series of books, but one in particular written by a guy named Doug Love called The Guide to the Caves of the Garrison Chapel Valley, which is this area just sort of west of Bloomington, Indiana, and it caused a big stir in Indiana and surrounding areas among cavers, because this guy just, you know, he sort of repurposed old maps and claimed them as his own and put them in this book. And so I was curious as to whether or not there was the same kind of situation there in West Virginia, but it sounds like it predates it by quite a bit.
It predates it. And actually, since William Davies was completely updated on a county-by-county basis by George Dasher, who is another astounding caver who has mapped cave after cave incredibly systematically in recent times. And so, for instance, Caves of Pendleton County is published, and he gives locations in that as well. I've got them all plotted in Google Earth now. So
there you go. Modern day. Is there anything there in West Virginia you can put your name on that is kind of known now, but you were one of the first ones there?
Yeah, we found a few. Just on the other side of the valley from Sites Pit, there's one, not a very big cave. It's like an 80-foot drop with some cave at the bottom that I found called Ginseng. We named it Ginseng Pit. We used to hang out at Grant's Tavern, which was opposite the campground. Grant and Edna Probst were a local West Virginia family. And on Friday, Saturday nights, cavers would hang out there and drink Stroh's 3.2 beer. And some of the local guys came and played music. So I'd take my banjo. I was just trying to learn at the time and sit in the back and listen to them. And I made friends with a couple of guys, the Day brothers, who lived on the top of one of these mountains. And so he took us ginseng hunting one day. We just basically hiked. We were ridge walking, essentially, and he was looking for ginseng that he was going to sell. And in the process, I found this entrance. So we went and got rope and rigged it. And it's not any particular fantastic drop, but it's there.
There it is.
It was pretty exciting for a 17-year-old, oh, I found a new cave kind of thing.
So then from there, I mean, did you kind of go back to across the pond before you ended up in the Himalayas?
So I came to America when I was 8 years old.
Yeah.
My father worked for the World Bank in Washington, D.C. And as long as I was a student, I had a visa to stay in America. So all the way through undergraduate in North Carolina, I did grad school in forestry. But when I graduated, I couldn't stay. I didn't have a visa to stay. I was no longer a student. So I went back to England and joined up with the British equivalent of the Peace Corps, voluntary service overseas. Mm-hmm. And my appointment was to a United Nations UNDP World Bank reforestry project in Nepal, with a group of international foresters assigned to some pretty remote forestry districts. My forestry district was 2 days' walk from a road, and the village I lived in, had no electricity. It had running water only for a couple of hours each day.
Wow.
And we helped build forest nurseries and do sort of village-level reforestation. I had 15 main nurseries in my area of responsibility, and it took me 30 days hiking to get to all of them and spend time with them. My forest district covered 300 square miles and had no roads in it.
To some people, that might sound miserable, but that sounds kind of heavenly to me.
It was the adventure of a lifetime. at the time, Nepal was sort of coming out of the Dark Ages. So it was very much like living in Dickensian England, if you can imagine. There were no wheels in my village.
Mm.
There were no wheeled vehicles in my community.
Wow. No wheels. Yeah. Imagine that.
Yeah. On top of that, I was about 4.5 days' walk from Dalagiri Base Camp, with the 8th highest mountain in the world.
Wow.
The same from Annapurna Base Camp. You can't imagine how exciting it was.
Oh, absolutely gorgeous, I'm sure. So was that then a hiatus from caving, a couple-year hiatus?
It was pretty much. I managed to get into a few caves there, but the Himalayas are still rising at about the same speed that your fingernail grows.
Wow.
So that doesn't allow for a lot of cave formation.
Yeah.
And so I got into a few small things, but yeah, pretty much caving stopped for the 6 years that I lived in Nepal.
Have you since checked up on the fruits of your labor from all those years ago? Like, has that forest come to the sort of fruition that you had wanted it to?
Yes.
Okay.
I speak Nepali fairly fluently.
Okay.
So I go back on sort of a 20 to 30 day trekking trip about every 2 years or so.
Oh, wow. You've kept that much.
And so we've stayed in real touch. I've got a very good friend who was a doctor with Save the Children Fund in Nepal. And he and I have gone to Kanchenjunga base camp. We've been up around the Tibetan border on the north side of Dalagiri on 30-day treks. We've sort of made a point of trying to get to some of the more remote parts of the country. As it opened up to tourism, areas like Everest Base Camp got totally destroyed. Mm. People flying in to Lukla, helicopters, hotels. It's not what it used to be. But as soon as you get away from there, the country is still fantastically remote. Mm. And pretty wild. So we've gone back, and on one of the trips, Matthew and I went back to the village where we were, and it was very interesting because he, as a doctor, he got back there and he sort of walked around and he said, you know, there's no goiters here. Well, in our day, a lot of people had these big throat goiters, which were caused by lack of iodine in the diet. But once you got a road pushed through, you could have iodized salt. And all the goiters disappeared.
Wow.
Vitamin A rickets, he didn't see that. I went back to one of my communities and was astounded to find one of the forest guards I'd worked with, who was probably 10 years older than me. And he very proudly walked me around almost 200 hectares of forest that when I was there was bare hillside. And they had, by dint of planting it a little bit, and then convincing the rest of the community not to overharvest it for firewood, all this forest had naturally come up among the plantations. And this was huge in terms of improving the water quality, runoff, erosion, that kind of thing. But the critical feature was not the work I did. It was the fact that roads had pushed through there and people were able to buy kerosene and use that for cooking on instead of cutting down the forest.
Ah, perfect.
So, you know, it's sort of that protected the forest more than even, you know, what I had been doing.
I was very curious about that. Sorry, I didn't mean to get away from caving, but that's fascinating and great work. I appreciated that. So back to caving.
So I left Nepal and came back to America and married my fiance, who she was in Nepal with me for 4 years. I married her after my 2 years of voluntary service. For some insane reason, she had waited for me. We got engaged, and I told her I was going away for 2 years.
Meant to be?
All her girlfriends told her to dump me, and she didn't. So we went back to Nepal, and then after that, we had a stint in Oxford at the university where I did some work there in the forestry science department. And then I was posted by the British government to Honduras in Central America. And that's when my caving really kicked off again. I was working on a sort of forest conservation project, and one part of that was cloud forest conservation on the tops of these 4,000 or 5,000 foot mountains. There were about 30 of them in the country, and they had been designated as national parks, but without anybody actually going there and drawing the boundaries and deciding whether they were biologically fit to be a park.
Mm.
So we hooked up with Missouri Botanic Gardens and the British Museum and the Honduras National University and started running expeditions to these mountains for about 3 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks at a time, and doing fairly quick, intensive botanical and biological inventories. And then that information could be used to determine which were the priorities of these parks to manage. My job was setting up these expeditions. It was exciting as could be. Again, up to fairly roadless areas, camping on the mountaintops, going out every day collecting plants. We had ornithologists. We had guys working on the herpetoflora, the lizards and the reptiles, snakes, that kind of thing. We had a couple of guys doing mammals who would come with us. We would load up 2 or 3 Land Rovers and, you know, drive to the base of these mountains, rent some mules or donkeys, transport a whole lot of gear to the top of the mountain, and then camp. And in the process, I saw all this limestone. with sinking streams.
How exciting.
That wasn't my work, and I couldn't be going exploring them, but I began to realize there was a lot of cave potential in the country.
Yeah.
After my first year there, I met at a British Embassy drinks party in Tegucigalpa, all standing around wearing suits and feeling incredibly bored and stuffed shirt kind of thing. Turned to the guy next to me, who was a British hydrogeologist, and I said, "Oh, you know, what do you do?" And he said, "Hydrogeology." And I said, "Oh, wait, that's water, and it's underground. Do you go in caves?" And that introduced me to Andy McKenzie, who became one of my best ever friends. He'd been a caver in England, and he was working on groundwater supply in Honduras. And so we said, "Hey, let's figure out the caves of the country." At the time, we were the only two cavers there, and very little had been done. Rick Finch, who I mentioned earlier from Tennessee Tech, had done some stuff in the Rio Atima area on the Santa Barbara Mountains in some pretty hairy vertical cave/river drops. But they had just done their trips, written it up, and then left. And they hadn't touched the rest of the country. So Andy and I figured, well, it wasn't safe for us to do vertical stuff with only two of us there and no other cavers in the country. So we set about essentially inventorying and exploring as much as we could find. Andy made a database that we could plug in all the published information that we could find. And then we took the topo maps for the country, split them up between us, highlighted all the limestone areas, looked for all the sinks and sinking rivers and streams, and then started going to those and immediately began to find caves that, just weren't known or hadn't been explored.
Man, some significant stuff too.
Yeah, there were some pretty good sized caves. I guess the biggest one we found was the Susmai River Cave. We'd seen this on the map, this sinking stream. The stream comes out of the mountain on one side and sinks in a great big sink on the other. This was in a Lancho in the western part of the country, which at the time was kind of the Wild West. A large part of it was being cleared and settled by cattle ranchers, but it was also on the edge of the Mosquitia. And that was the time of the Iran-Contra war, and the U.S. were supporting bringing in Contras to fight in Nicaragua, and they were going in through Olancho. So it was a slightly tricky area to get to. Mm. For instance, we weren't allowed to have topo maps. They were considered military secrets.
Oh, wow.
So we had to hide them. We'd get stopped by these army checkposts and things as we took our Land Rovers on these back roads. But for the most part, the Contra war was winding down, and we could get out into the countryside and we were fine. We drove to the sinking side of this Susmai stream, and there's a sinkhole about 200 feet across. And it's got a small river dropping into it, a foot deep, 15 feet wide sort of thing, stream really. But standing up in this sinkhole, as if you dropped a handful of chopsticks into it, were giant trees, 60 feet tall, 30 feet tall.
Wow.
And had all been churned around at some point, like you were running them into a kitchen disposer. So at some time, this stream floods incredibly dramatically.
Wow.
So we poked around in there and couldn't get in. There weren't any ways into this. So we then turned around and followed it upstream, hit the sort of headwall on the mountain where it came out, climbed up maybe 50 feet, and then almost immediately dropped into the cave, another 50 feet down back to the water, and were faced with a swim about the length of an Olympic swimming pool. Pitch black at that point. We're out of reach of the entrance. So we turned on our lights and set off thinking we were going to be able to sort of wade in and touch the bottom. And we couldn't touch the bottom, and you couldn't hold on to the sides. And we sort of thrashed our way up through this, thinking we were going to drown with our boots and packs pulling us down as we went.
Oh.
Got to the other side of this, and then followed the stream up into the mountain for kilometers.
Wow.
7 or 8 hours of caving. Beautiful cave. And we reached what was essentially the obvious end of the cave at a fairly good-sized sump, where just a great big pool of water, and you could see where it dove down. And at that point, Andy and I were pretty much finished. We'd been wet and cold most of the time, and we'd been in there a long time already. And Andy said, "Right, I'm done. You know, we're turning around, going back." And I said, "Give me just a second. I'm going to look in this little crawlway that goes off underneath here." And I crawled into it, went about 100 to 200 feet, and came into what I would call Fossil River Passage. That was, 100 feet high and 100 feet wide, with a cobbled floor. And it wound off into the mountainside. You could drive a couple of buses through it.
Wow.
And I started jogging up this, knowing, nobody's ever been here before. And just an unbelievable feeling.
Wow.
And that was the key to the main part of the Susmai River cave system, was that little crawlway.
Goodness gracious. That's incredible. And so then, did anyone return for mapping efforts?
So we made, Andy and I made 5 trips altogether. All exploration. We, with just 2 of us, mapping really wasn't an option in terms of the time we had.
Right.
I should say that we both had kids and wives, and so we'd take off for the weekend, leaving the kids and the wives together. But you can only do that for so long,
Right.
Wait for 3 days.
You gotta build up some goodwill. Yeah, exactly.
So we didn't do mapping. We just did exploration. When we finally finished, Andy's had a 2-year contract. I stayed for another couple of years. We wrote up a checklist of the caves of Honduras, essentially listing everything we'd found. We took Andy's database and turned it into this document. It contained quite a lot of information about the archaeology that we'd found, because we found Indian remains as well as just new caves and stuff. So we didn't publish it. We just gave it to the relevant government authorities who might hopefully be involved in some kind of conservation or looking after them. The Department of Mines. I remember I gave a copy to the director of the Peace Corps, who was particularly interested in, should these areas be protected, that kind of thing.
Sure.
And at the time, we hadn't counted on the internet and scanners and things, because at some point, copies of it got spread out around the world, and an Italian speleological club from Rome got a copy of it and decided they were going to go to that Rio Susmai area and map the stuff we'd found. And so they made it was almost a 3-month expedition. They set up a base camp there and mapped not only the Susmai cave, but several others that were in the area.
Have you since seen those maps?
It's long been a sore point. They would show me them, but not give me one.
Oh, good heavens.
We all got together again in 2005 at the first speleological conference of Central America. And Andy and I were invited to do a presentation on the work we'd done with our checklist. And that's when we met the Italians. And we went to a number of caves with them. And I sort of badgered them, you got to give me a copy.
Well, yeah.
I never got one. And they let me see it. Parts that we had found were not on their map.
Oh.
So that's even more. I've got to go back. However, in 2014 it was, Hurricane Mitch parked itself on top of Honduras for about 5 days.
Oh, wow.
And just flooded the country in some of the worst flooding imaginable. And although I wasn't there, I was in communication with a guy who lived upstream of the Susmai Caves. And the valley above, which Andy and I had suspected fed into the drainage of it, fed into the cave, flooded during Hurricane Mitch and formed a lake about 1/4 mile across and 1/2 mile long. And it took almost 2 months for that lake to drain. And almost certainly it drained through the Susmai cave.
Wow.
And so that catastrophic flooding that Andy and I had seen signs of in the sinkhole was repeated in 2014 when Hurricane Mitch came. And so we don't know whether the interior of the cave has changed or not. Would it have pushed around some of the cobble fill, that kind of stuff? That would have been an immense amount of water to drive through that cave.
Gosh, I would imagine that would alter it a little bit.
Yeah. So I'd like to go back, but the situation with the drug cartels there and the sort of violence in the country has kept us from doing so.
Yeah. You found another cool one there. I'm terrible at the proper pronunciations, but La Cueva de Siete Quebradas?
Exactly. Cueva de Siete Quebradas. That was a really fun one. Small cave, we thought. Andy and I were essentially checking out caves using one of the rivers to sort of hike down. And we spotted a spring coming up in the river itself. You could, instead of the muddy water, here was this patch of super clear water.
Ooh.
And so started looking uphill directly above that and found a very, very narrow entrance that I could just barely fit through. And I'm pretty skinny. So, you know, we're not talking very big. And we dropped down from that back to the spring that made that stream. We followed it upstream and it divided, you know, okay, which of these two forks do we follow? And then that divided. And there were a total of seven streams in this thing altogether. In one of them, there was a hot springs, which is pretty unusual to find geologically active there. And this guy, Rick Finch, who I mentioned earlier, geologist from Tennessee Tech University, he had done his doctorate on the geology of that quadrangle. And he'd got a copy of my write-up of the caves, the checklist of the caves of Honduras. And in it, I had mentioned that there was a hot spring in this cave. And somehow in producing it, the temperature of the water had been reported in centigrade, not in Fahrenheit, which made it a very, very hot spring, which it wasn't, more like 100 degrees Fahrenheit. So Rick was determined to see this rather unusual geological feature, and he went back with hammers and chisels and opened up the entrance so they could fit in. And then they mapped the cave. And I went, they did, I think it was three trips altogether. They did one trip with Avis and Moni Gerald mapping. I came in on their last one and showed them some of the sections that they hadn't seen that Andy and I had found, and then we finished the map off. It's a beautiful little cave. It's got some fantastic crystals in one of the side rooms that sort of a wall of crystals about 50 or 60 feet high. Just the entire wall just glitters.
Have you then kept up in any way, well, it seems like you have, with the caves that you've discovered down there? Like, have you been able, I guess you said that the drug cartels make it difficult to go back, but has news reached you of any of the discoveries that you made down there? Has anything become of them?
Well, there's two stories I would mention. One is the cave of the crystal skulls or the glowing skulls, the Talgua River cave.
Oh,
I'll
wow.
get to that in just a second.
Okay.
But the Sushmai cave is kind of fun because, you know, we didn't tell people about it and we didn't publicize it. Well, it's in the Lonely Planet guide now, you know, encouraging tourists to go there and hire a local to take you into the cave.
Oh, boy.
So I'm not quite sure what's, you know, what's going on there. If you Google it on the internet, you know, there's various world travelers, not cavers, who've, you know, oh, yeah, I went to the Sushmai cave. I don't know how they deal with that first swim.
Some adventurous folks.
But the Talgua River cave, or just the Talgua cave, is now known as the cave of the glowing skulls or the crystal skulls. And that's one, if you look it up on the internet, there's a lot of information about it. Andy and I wanted to go there and check it out. We'd heard about it from several other people. It's near the town of Catacamas, and a lot of Hondurans had gone in it. It's not a difficult cave, but it had a reported couple of second entrances that up on some cliffs way in the back. And so Andy and I went and found them and did a sort of sketch map of how they tied into the rest of the cave. And it was a long trip. I think we spent 8 or 9 hours doing that. But in the process, we passed under this passage, sort of in the main cave areas as you go in, which has a long chimney shooting up to the ceiling that you can't really get to. You can't climb into it without some kind of climbing gear or building some sort of wooden platform.
Mm.
But in 1994, a guy named Jorge Yanez, a Honduran, and a Peace Corps named Don and two other guys who I don't know the names of went in the Talgor cave sort of recreationally and looked up in that crack and said, I wonder what's there. Went back out and got a ladder and put it up there. And about 35 feet up, there's a side passage that they stuck their heads in. And you almost immediately can see into a large rimstone bathtub chamber in this room. And in it are 24 bones sets, sort of bodies, where at some point in the past, local Indians had taken the deceased and cleaned the bones up, stacked them up lengthwise, put the skull on top and set them in this ossuary, basically. And then over the subsequent years, probably 1,000 years, it had filled up with water at various times and had deposited calcite over everything.
Wow.
So you got these skulls that when you looked at them, you shine your light on them, they just glow and reflect.
Oh, goodness.
And this obviously was major news. And Jorge Yanez set off back to the capital in Tegucigalpa and got the archaeology department involved. And they got a guy named James Brady from George Washington University. And I think they had some money from National Geographic. And they came out and did some, you know, some archaeology and some excavations on it. And they carbon dated it and determined that these bones were pre-Mayan. So they were pre the major civilization that made up Honduras and Guatemala. They were older than that. And the other cool thing is they found out that from the carbon ratio in the teeth, that these people didn't eat corn, that they were before the domestication of maize.
Wow.
Which is a pretty amazing aspect. They studied some of the area outside the cave and found a second cave called Spider Cave, which also has a similar burial ossuary in the very back of it. And there's a very cool little video on YouTube of James Brady getting into the back of Spider Cave because it's very, very tight and small. In 2005, when Andy and I went back to present at this caving conference, we met Jorge Yanez and said to him, oh, you know, we used to explore Talgor Cave. Any chance we can get in there? And he said, well, it's now a national park and you pay an entrance fee and there's like a walkway through the cave. But the actual ossuary where the bones are is locked and you can't go in, you can't see it. Nobody gets to see it. They just get to see the cave. And we said, oh, that's too bad. You sure? And he said, oh, all right. You know, I have the key. And he took us there. He took about 5 or 6 of us from the caving conference. And I couldn't believe it. They literally just allowed us to walk in amongst these bones. They've removed the biggest, most obvious ones to a museum. There were some incredibly delicate marble pots there. Not ceramic, marble. Which
marble.
Had to be technically really difficult to do.
Well, yeah, you got to carve it out.
You got to carve them out, yeah. And to this day, they don't know how they did them. So they found some, you know, really cool stuff there. And there we are standing there with our caving gear and our flashlights looking at these remains. It was just really astounding.
Wow, you lucked out on that one. Persistence.
Yeah. And thanks to Jorge.
You went back to Central America to collect plants and you found caves at the top of this Table Mountain?
So the Table Mountain actually was in Suriname.
Oh, okay.
In South America.
South America.
That was an expedition I did with the Missouri Botanical Gardens. Nobody had been to the top of this Table Mountain since 1945 when a botanist went there and made the only trip to it. It's got sheer sides about 1,000 feet. Straight up all around. So it's incredibly difficult to get onto the top of. It's the easternmost Table Mountain in the chain of tepuis that stretches all the way to Venezuela.
Okay.
So these Roiramas are sort of relic forests, trapped islands of cool forest trapped in a tropical forest
right
down below them. And so Missouri Botanic Gardens decided that there had to be, you know, some pretty rare plants up there. And they organized an expedition to figure out how to get onto it. and they flew around the whole thing. And on one side, there are a couple of places where it's a sort of a talus slope, and then only a short length of cliff. And, you know, with ropes and vines and what have you, you can get up onto the top there. I went on the second and third expeditions. We took, I think the first one was 21 days, and the next one was 26 days or so. And we took, you know, a ton of freeze-dried food, hired a bunch of local guys. We got flown in to the nearest airstrip and then hiked for 2 days to the base of the mountain and then climbed up onto the ridge and then just made a camp on the top and set off collecting plants. Every young kid's dream of I'm the first person in the wilderness. There were no trails. I would set out in the morning with Tudor Indians to help me cut trail. I don't speak Suriname. They don't speak English. We did it all by hand signals, figuring out where to go and where we might find unusual plants, and worked our way essentially across the top of this Table Mountain to get to the summit of it. But it's sandstone. These tepuis are almost all sandstone. And so in my mind, you know, it never occurred to me to think of caves.
Sure.
It doesn't happen. But it turns out that at least for the top area and probably for large parts of it, it's sand held together with a sort of calcareous mix, which is dissolved by solution and makes caves. And we had one day where we got to the very top of this ridge, fantastic views over the side. You know, remember, there's been no hunting there. There's been no human activity on this thing at all. And so there's wild pig, there's tapirs, there's howler monkeys, and there are pythons. There were pythons up there as big around as my leg and 20 feet long. And we're hiking around on this sandstone and every now and then seeing one of these big snakes. So I'm exceedingly concerned about the snakes.
Right.
I'm not fond of snakes at the best of times. But while looking for plants, we found this cave entrance and had to go in.
Well, of course.
But who's going to be inside? I was like, in the back of my mind, there's going to be one of these giant snakes in there.
Oh, no.
We only had small flashlights. We didn't have caving gear. It was just myself and one other botanist, an American guy, a moss specialist. He was interested in the entrance where the mosses were, so I pushed down in, but I couldn't go very far by myself. So that's still there, waiting for a return journey.
Oh, my goodness.
And to find the rest of the caves. And it is clear since then, the Venezuelan tepuis, they found massive, massive caves on the top of the Roraimas there in the same formation, sandstone formations. And Rick Finch and those friends, they went and did a couple of those caves in the 2000s. So I got to see the ones in Suriname. They got to see the ones in Venezuela.
Goodness. Formed kind of the same way.
Formed in the same way. Exactly. Same kind of deposits.
Mm.
Yeah.
Speaking of non-limestone caves, I'm intrigued by these salt caves in Chile.
Yeah. The Atacama Desert was probably one of the highlights of the caving. Rick Finch, who put together this proposal, you know, we need an excuse to go caving around the world. Let's try and see every single geological type of cave there is. You know, some marble caves, salt caves, massive limestone in Borneo. But the salt caves are interesting because they only occur in a few places in the world. You need, obviously, salt domes of some kind. Turns out there's a lot of salt in the world. New York State is underlain by lots of salt.
Mm.
Almost all of the road salt that's dumped on America comes from Chile. It comes from the Atacama Desert. We don't mine our own. We ship it up from there.
Huh.
And you need a setting where there's not much rain. You need just enough rain to dissolve a solutional passage. But if you have too much rain, the roof gets eroded away and it becomes a canyon.
Right.
And so Israel has some, and then the Atacama Desert. Well, the Atacama Desert is the driest place in the world, apart from, say, Antarctica. It gets about 6 millimeters of rain per year on average. So less than a quarter inch.
Yeah.
And for it's suspected that for almost 300 years, no rain fell at all. Rick knew that there were salt caves there. There was an article in the NSS News from about 5 years prior from some American cavers who'd been to a section of the Atacama called Valle de la Luna. Well, that's now, since those guys went there, it had been turned into a park. And you can visit the caves in Valle de la Luna, but you're sort of kind of constrained of staying in the park, staying on the boundaries, on the path, that kind of thing. But we were looking to find, you know, newer stuff that was outside the park. So we rented a couple of old four-wheel drive pickup trucks and set out to the sort of southern end of the main salt dome that's above the salt flats. There's these sort of miles and miles of salt flats. And then there's domes on the side where the salt has been pushed up geologically. And that's where the caves are most likely to be found. And the only limitation we had was in getting across the salt flats to the caves. And that's because Augusto Pinochet, when he was the dictator running Chile, was paranoid about being invaded by Bolivia and Peru and Argentina. And so he instructed his generals to put landmines out on all the border areas.
Oh, my goodness.
They put out about 120,000 landmines in most of the flatter areas where you would be an invading army coming. And so there's landmines around this area. We talked backwards and forwards. Well, how do we drive these jeeps across? Well, the trick, it turns out, was to find lines where geological prospectors had been in before us, mm-hmm. then to follow their vehicle tracks and not get off on the sides of them. And we figured once we were on the salt dome, there weren't going to be any landmines. We could just hike around. But it was getting to them that was the challenge.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
Yeah, we had some interesting discussions over beers, like, you know, where should we go? Is this going to be safe?
Did you see evidence of landmines?
Yeah, we've got a great photograph of us playing in front of a sign warning, you know, don't go behind this sign, landmines present. Oh. They know approximately where they are, but they haven't been able to demine. There's still something like 100,000 of them left. Mm. Occasionally a cow blows up or somebody gets killed. So by driving in the tracks of a geological prospector's way across the salt flat, we managed to get to the edge of these domes. And we found two or three of these. And it's just fascinating to be in a cave that's made of salt. All the crystals in them are quadrangular, like a salt crystal that you would shake on your, except bigger. They tend to form pits that drop in fairly straight down, and then they hit this base layer and meander along until they come out on the edge of the salt flat. It's really, really hot in the Atacama Desert. So outside it's 90, 95 degrees and as dry as you can imagine. And inside the cave, the temperature drops about 8 or 10 degrees, and it's beautifully comfortable, I would say. But you're getting salt ground into you all the time.
Oh, gosh, I would imagine.
So you drink a lot of water. Really, it was fascinating to see. One of the things that really intrigued me was in one of the caves, Cueva del Zorro. It was named because an Andean desert fox had used it as its sort of shelter. We found sort of woven hemp remains of like headband or basket or something. So these caves had been used by the local Indians over the years. And again, was it 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago? It was preserved by the salt. And that gets you started asking, well, how did people live here in these really harsh conditions? You know, what did they do?
Yeah.
Well, the Spanish conquered it. And, you know, they sort of came in with Spanish Western technology, but they conquered the Incas. And the Incas conquered the Indians who lived there prior to that. They were called the Chinchorro culture, and they lived there from about 7,000 BC onwards. So one of the questions is, well, was the climate different? And the answer is it must have been a little bit wetter, because you could see on some of the volcanic mountain slopes around the Atacama Desert the remains of terracing, as if they'd tried to grow crops there, and they'd been long since abandoned. But the other question we had was, everybody told us when we got there, you have to buy bottled water. You can't drink any of the water that you find around here. Mm. And that's because it contains arsenic, along with the sort of salt and the lithium and the boron and the other chemicals that have piled up in the desert. Mm. Arsenic is present. And so the water has arsenic about 100 times higher in concentration than is recommended for human consumption.
Wow.
So you drink bottled water. But then you immediately ask the question, well, what did these Indians do? How did they live here? Yeah. You know, they didn't have bottled water. And it wasn't until I got back to America and started Googling this, you know, like arsenic and Atacamas, and up popped a couple of articles that the Indians, the Chinchorro culture Indians, had very recently been studied and found to have a mutation that none of the rest of us have in the rest of the world that allows them to excrete arsenic.
Oh, my goodness.
So their bodies have evolved this chance mutation to allow them to live in this incredibly harsh area without dying of poisoning.
Incredible.
It's what I find fascinating about caving. You know, as you go and you see these places, then you ask questions.
Right, right. And you get answers.
You get answers. And, you know, a lot of cavers just go, you know, I'm a project caver. I'm working in this particular cave, and I go 100 times and I map it and I go home. But I go and ask questions.
So here's a question. So these salt caves, I mean, are these big passages? Are they smaller passages? It sounds like you can't really expect the same things from these salt caves as you can from, say, limestone caves.
No, not at all. Not at all. So the domes dropping down in are 30, 40 feet wide and maybe 70 to 100 feet deep. Okay. And that's an immediate challenge right there, because you can't bolt into salt.
Right.
It's actually really like a salt mud layer cake that these caves are formed in.
Huh.
It's the salt flats, mud piled up, salt, mud. And then over time, the whole thing got lifted up, this layer cake. And then the salt, as it's compressed, rises towards the surface and becomes more concentrated. Mm. But it's still got a lot of silt mixed in with it. So it's incredibly prone to eroding away. So you get these pits that drop straight down, which we could find from the top or see from the bottom, but we weren't set up to rig them and drop them. And what we would find the entrances at the bottom, and they would be the size of, you know, say 10 foot by 8 foot, something like that, winding into the hillside until they intersected one of these domes.
Huh.
So quite small, winding in. The biggest rooms we found were maybe 30, 40 feet by 50 feet.
Okay.
But a lot of hands and knees crawling over salt.
Over salt.
Yeah.
And because it's so warm in there, are you in shorts? Are you then getting salt in, you know, onto your knees?
Yeah. So there is one other problem with caving in the Atacama Desert, and that is the ozone layer. We used refrigerant that killed for years in our air conditioning and refrigerators.
Right, right.
That destroyed the ozone layer. And particularly in Chile and that southern area, there's still, although we've banned the CFCs that caused the damage, there's still holes in the ozone layer in that area.
Mm.
And in fact, in the town of San Pedro de Atacamas, it's the only place I've seen this, they had signage indicating how long you could stay out in the sun.
Wow. Okay.
Before you would have, you know, skin cancer issues. And it varied by day. They had a kind of a red, green, yellow light system. All the workers there, everybody who does any kind of construction work, is covered head to toe with clothing, lightweight overalls, hat, stuff that drapes over the back of your neck.
Sure.
You know, and lots of suntan lotion.
Yeah.
So you know, we did a lot of ridge walking, but we're wearing, you know, lightweight pants and long sleeve shirts and you know, cowboy hats, trying to keep out of the sun as much as possible.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, that was a challenge. So it was always great when, okay, now we're in the cave, you know, and you can sort of peel off a little bit.
Right. So you met up with some of my favorite people, these incredible Indiana cavers, by chance, it seems like. Tony and Marion Akers?
Yes, total serendipity. And it's changed the last, well, just it being fantastically fortuitous. I was working at the Philadelphia Flower Show. I was chair of horticulture for the competitive classes. And that meant that for 10 days, I was there pretty much every day, people bringing plants in, they're competing, looking, you know, trying to get ribbons and awards. And the flower show is big. It covers about 3 acres underground. And a third of it is the marketplace section off to one side of where we had the competitive classes. And these are all the people running booths selling their goods. And my wife came over to me one day. She was there sort of visiting. And she'd been looking around the shops, and she came over and said, you ought to go look at the marketplace. There's these guys named Marion and Tony. They're selling pottery from Mexico, but they said they go caving. They said they're cavers. So I pretty much dropped everything I was doing.
All right. Say no more.
Headed over, and there was Marion and Tony and Simon surrounded by all this fantastic pottery that Tony imports through Carlota Gardens.
Yeah.
And they told me about the Proyecto Sierra Mazateca that they've been running for 20 years or so. And that was 2015. So in 2016, I somehow parlayed that into an invite to go along and was immediately blown away by what they've got going on there. You know, there's big, big, big caves in Mexico.
Yeah.
You know, it made my West Virginia stuff look small. they're looking for some pretty big, deep things on the top of the Sierra. And it's very different from like the Wautla project, where they're single-mindedly looking at the Pesh system, or Cheve, where they get 60 or 70 people and park outside the cave and just do the cave. Tony and company are sort of essentially, you know, exploring lots of different areas of this massive mountain, ridge walking, looking for caves and mapping what they found. And I just yesterday, I received a whole lot of maps from Marion. Marion is a brilliant cartographer.
Isn't she the best?
Some of the best I've seen.
Yeah.
Tony's a astoundingly good cave rigger. But some of these other Indiana cavers who I didn't know before this, they've all got these unique skill sets that combine to make 10, 12 people expeditions to the tops of these mountains. And we set up camp in some remote spot and ridge walk and look for caves and sinkholes and stay for a couple of weeks. Socially, it's really fun. Culturally, learning about the Mazatec and the Mixtec culture in the process. We've had some serious adventures. I'm not going to talk too much about the nuts and bolts of how Tony and Marion do it, because you've got to have.
Oh, I know. I've had Tony on for a short little thing that we did, because I talked to him at Indiana Cave Capers, and I've talked to him, you know, off the podcast and stuff, and I've got to have Marion on as well. But yeah, I got to let them get into it.
Yeah, you could team, you know, Tony, Marion, and Rand Hieslet.
Yeah.
Rand, somehow he and I hit it off. But man, if I ever felt I had a brother.
Yeah,
Rand is it. He's one of the coolest, hardest working cavers, but such a nice guy.
Oh, he's a tremendous guy, and I want to talk to him about that. But I also want to talk. He's heading up the Binkley project in Indiana, our longest cave. So I mean, I could talk to him for hours just on that, you know. But
yes,
to talk to him about this as well, I mean, to get all these Proyecto Sierra Mazateca people together would be something else.
Yeah.
Oh, but that's so great.
Let me mention two little stories that, again, sort of caving, but tied in. One of the things is, you know, I'm sort of a forester, I'm sort of a botanist, and I'm sort of a caver. And they all overlap in that Venn diagram somehow.
Yeah.
So when I'm up on the Sierra Mazateca, I'm looking at all these amazing plants. We're hiking around. You set out in the morning, you sharpen your machete, and off you go. The cavers in the group, Rusty Riley and Ron and all these other guys, they're going off during the daytime to look for caves. And ostensibly, that's what I'm doing too. But when I see an interesting plant, you know, I'm all over it. And we set off one morning, myself and Simon Akers. I guess he was his first year of high school then, so just the two of us. Mm-hmm. We tend to break up into small groups, try to cover as much area as possible, cut some trail, you know, go for 4 or 5 hours, hit a turnaround point and come back, hopefully, you know, aim for a big sinkhole or whatever we think we can find. And when we get back to camp, everybody compares notes. Oh, I found this 100-foot pit, or I found this thing that you drop a rock down and it goes forever, or whatever it might be. So we go out. I find these insectivorous plants called butterworts, pinguinculas. And I've been looking for these things all over South America, Central America. They're pretty rare, but Mexico is a center of diversity for pinguinculas. And I find a bunch of them on these rocks in this giant sinkhole that Simon and I have gone to investigate. And you know, I get all excited and take lots of photographs. And we come back to camp in the evening, and Simon has got this sort of jaundiced high school look. You know, everybody's saying, what did you find? What did you do? And Simon says, yeah, well, Tom found these plants and had this plantgasm.
Oh, that's marvelous.
Next day, Rand comes back with some photographs, and he's found a big colony of them.
Oh, and, wow.
So I had to go out and see. I had to go out and see that. He'd taken photographs of them. And, it's an opportunity to hit some pretty unusual plants. Just finding that quantity of butterworts is grounds for conservation of these mountains in the sense of these should be some kind of park, national park or something. Mm-hmm. And the other story was I set off one day by myself to hike along the ridge top where the cliff drops down to the town of San Juan de Quetzalpan with this, you know, probably 1,000 foot down, 800 feet down or something. So I was pretty sure I couldn't get lost. And I was also moderately sure there weren't going to be caves up there, but I was interested in getting as far out on this ridge as I could and seeing back into the interior of the mountain. I figured out the trail. I took my machete and I sort of cut trail up there. And partway along, I noticed some scratches on one of the trees, quite high up, like 4 feet off the ground. And then shortly thereafter, some. Can I swear on this?
Go ahead.
Catch.
Okay. Oh no.
And I thought, well, this is interesting. And then I kept going. Finished my day, and the next day I took a guy named Pedro and a younger Mixtec Indian woman named Itzel to the very far point where they could see this was the edge of the land of their community. And they were interested in seeing that for sort of a sense of where did San Juan de Quetzalpan's territory start and finish sort of thing. So I took them back to this spot and didn't see this stuff on the trail. Somehow I had lost my trail and taken them up a slightly different way. So several days later, it's raining. We've got a day where we're not doing anything. I thought, I'm going to go back and find that. Was that jaguar? Was that puma? You know, what was going on there? And so I hiked back up there. And for 2 hours, I went backwards and forwards over that hillside. Actually, sure, I knew where it was. At the end of the 2 hours, I find it and, you know, fill up a Ziploc bag with the poop. It's big. This is a puma or a jaguar. And so I come hiking back into camp at the end of the day, and everybody says, did you find any caves?
No, but
I got cat. But that's actually really important because the presence of big predatory cats on a mountain like that indicates that it's still very intact forest, that it's large enough to support a population of these animals. And again, a very strong reason for advocating for it to be made into a park.
Yeah, megafauna. Wow.
And that was the same trip we found El Mero Olla Cave, that dropped 530 feet or something. It took us 3 days to, wow. It took Tony, well, the first day they rigged it, but we split up into three teams. Three people went in and rigged it. They ran out of rope. I went in on the second day with myself, Pete Zabrock, and Simon with more rope, and we rigged it down to the bottom, dropped it down to the bottom. And then the third day, Marion and Rand and somebody else went in and mapped it and then de-rigged it, coming back out. Mm-hmm. Pretty exciting stuff for a kid from who grew up in West Virginia vertical.
Well, okay, so you're working with Marion on the Fern Cave resurvey. Is it a resurvey?
It's really pulling together the existing survey.
Okay.
In fact, I'm going down there tomorrow.
Are you?
Yeah, we're going to be down there for five more days on our next survey. Marion, Tony, and
oh gosh, tell them all I said hi.
I'll do that. Yeah, Steve Pitts knew Marion, and I guess her cartography experience and the Indiana Binkley knowledge convinced him that we would be a reasonable group to pick up the survey that had been going until about 2005. They had made 85 different trips to survey Fern Cave, and then it got shut because of Whitenose, mm-hmm. By the Fish and Wildlife Service. It got shut completely because of the gray bat colony. I think it's the largest gray bat colony left.
Yeah.
And they're very strict about that. The only access now is to Surprise Pit, and it's very well monitored by remote cameras and a permit system. But the rest of the cave was sort of off limits. So the survey basically just stopped. And then COVID came along and it stopped a bit more. So when we were there in November, Steve had been looking for some way to get this together, both to take the existing survey data and then find all the sections where it hadn't been finished and try to resurvey, tie in, and close all the loops and actually get a map produced. And so he offered it up to us, and it took all of 5 seconds for me to say, oh my God,
are you kidding me?
It's astounding. But it's gonna be a very long project. It's a very, very complex cave. It's got 18 different levels. It's crazy deep, you know.
Is it really that many?
Yeah, it's the existing survey indicates that there's 18 different levels where it takes off for.
Wow.
And we're just at the point, really, of Steve is busy showing us or teaching us the cave and showing us areas where we should tie our surveys in and start. So we've done a little bit of surveying. We'll do some more this next week, and we're going to follow up for the next months and months.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah, let's see. It was who was it? Was it Tony and Joe Kinder? Or it was Joe Kinder and somebody.
Oh, Greg McNamara.
It was Greg and Joe. Yes. Yeah. And yes. What a fun time it looked like.
Yeah, it would be very interesting to get Steve Pitts and Jennifer Pinkley on your podcast.
I've gotten Jennifer. I've got to get Steve.
Oh, I've got to listen to the Jennifer one then.
Yeah. She talked about the book. She was just wonderful to talk to about Fern Cave and about everything she's done. I mean, she's incredible.
I have to say, your podcast is an astounding resource for cavers. I've been listening to it as I drive. I mean, Alabama's 12 hours away from me, so I've got these pretty long drives.
Where are you?
I'm in Pennsylvania.
You're in Pennsylvania. Okay, gotcha.
Outside Philadelphia. So I've been listening to your podcast, and I'd listened to a few of them before, but now I've heard a lot more, and it opens up the caving community. I suddenly feel like I know lots of these people you're interviewing a lot better, and it broadens the whole world of caving in a big way, and that's really important.
I really appreciate that. This just started as a thing I thought would be fun, and 5 years later here we are. You and me are talking. This has been an incredible talk. Thank you so much. I have a strange request. I see your banjo behind you.
Yes.
Would you mind playing yourself out?
Not at all. It's
that's marvelous. Thank you. Thank you for sharing your caving life with us. And I hope to meet you in person someday.
Yeah, I've got a standing invite to come to Indiana and get muddy in Binkley.
Well,
so it's on my to-do list, and I'll definitely have to look you up.
I'll have to keep up with Rand then and find out when and if you're coming. So
yeah,
that'd be great.
It's not an if, it's when.
Okay, all right. Thomas, thank you.
You're very welcome. It's a delight to talk to you.
Oh, wasn't that nice? Wasn't that nice of him to do that? He just picked it up off the filing cabinet and started playing. It was so cool. Oh, and what a great caving life. Thomas Hawkins, really, really appreciate you giving me so much time and sharing your caving life with us. And thank you for listening. Hey, next month, I cannot believe I've got these guys. Matt Bowers hooked me up with Jonathan Bird and Todd Kelly. They're divers, cave divers. But Jonathan Bird was just a scuba diver before he became cave diver certified around 10 years ago, something like that. But Todd Kelly's been a cave diver for decades. And together they produced the IMAX movie, or Omnimax, whatever you want to call it, giant screen movie called Ancient Caves, which is currently screening in a couple locations. Cincinnati is the closest to me, and I swear I'm going to go see it. But they are what we have to look forward to on May 1st. Thank you to all the sponsors, past and present. Swago, swagogear.com. Get you one of those shiny new waterproof packs. And Organic Robot on Etsy, the brick and mortar store in Greenfield, Indiana, organicrobotdesigns.com. He's also got the Etsy shop. If your grotto needs shirts, Charlie's your man. They're great for fundraising, and it's just nice to represent the grotto. And maybe you could even get a few new members from wearing that shirt loud and proud. He can even help you with the design if you're not so sure you can pull that off. And, of course, our current sponsor, El Spelio. Go to elspelio.com and pick up the last caving light you'll ever need. Don't forget to use the promo code PODCAST. If you spend more than $300, you'll save $20 at elspelio.com. All right, I think that's everything. Is that everything? I hope you get to go caving this month. I'm going to get to go caving in May. Maybe not this month. But I do plan to take the kids to a little cave this weekend. Got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old. And fingers crossed they like it. All right, until next time, kill nothing but time.